Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
All right, you are back in the House of Mystery, and we are at the interview part of the show. Joining us is a man that's really done it all. What caught me was his book on Sherlock Holmes, which came out in June 1st. It's The Wild Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, but he's got a huge career, so we'll get to it now. So thank you for joining us today, Will Murray.
So happy to be here.
Well, I don't know where to start. So before we get to the book, how did you get into a career like you've had? Like, you've had an amazing career. I see you've done all sorts of stuff.
Like a lot of things, I stumbled backwards into multiple opportunities, and it wasn't a linear thing. I think I first started in fanzines writing about pulp magazines, which was an interest of mine, pulp magazines of the 1930s and 40s, specifically the characters of Doc Savage and The Shadow. And that somehow grew into a kind of an octopus of opportunities, which included ghostwriting the famous Destroyer paperback series, of which I did 40, and writing Doc Savage, which I did through my association with Lester Dent's widow, Norma Dent. Lester Dent was the author of Doc Savage. He wrote as Kenneth Robeson. And I had the opportunity to turn some of his unfinished works into novels, and I'm still writing the occasional Doc Savage to this day. I also had a long career writing for magazines, specifically the Starlog group of magazines, where I covered films around the world and interviewed, comic book people, movie people, TV people, and science fiction people and horror people. And, we could go down other pathways, but basically over time my career aggregated or accumulated, you might say. It was like a snowball, but it rolled uphill instead of downhill.
Huh. I was going to say, but when you take, you do a lot of characters that are mystery and crime solving, like you look
right.
at The Shadow, for instance, and stuff. When you write those characters, where do you get the ideas from, and how do you keep it true to form?
Well, when I write Doc Savage and The Shadow and things that are set in the 1930s or 40s or whatever time frame, as often as not, I'm working with outlines, premises, unfinished manuscripts. So I plug into that that writer, his characters, and the time period. People sometimes ask me, how do you write a story set in 1933 when the year is 20 something. And I said, well, I don't write consciously a story set in 1933. I write as if I'm a contemporary writer writing in 1933. In other words, I immerse myself in that time period, but mostly in the sensibility of the source material. And I try to avoid self-consciously writing in a specific year because I don't want to sound artificial. So certain things are taken for granted. I don't, in other words, I don't usually throw in historical characters or allusions. I just try to say, okay, it's 1933, this is what the world's like, and this is what the cars are like, and these are what telephones are like, and we're going to have a story. And, you know, it helps a lot if you have some fragmentary manuscript. I've had a lot of access to a lot of these things. So when you type someone else's manuscript to start a story, which I've had the privilege to do several times, it kind of plugs you in. It's a kind of channeling. You know, someone reviewed one of my recent books featuring a character who's like the shadow, the spider, and the reviewer said, you know, this guy is interesting. He writes like the spider writer when he writes the spider, but he writes like the Doc Savage writer when he writes Doc Savage, and he writes like the shadow writer when he writes the shadow. How does he do that? Well, I'm not going to tell how I do that, but I just sort of explained it. You know, I mean, there's something else going on, too, but, you know, it's a gift.
So, Will, I have a question.
Sure.
When you're writing these stories, even with the Sherlock Holmes stories, are you worried about the anachronisms, or are you pretty you have a strong base to understand what happened at that time?
I'm always concerned about anachronisms and errors. This is why I have a team of editors who will read my stuff and give me feedback. I think the thing I worry about with Sherlock Holmes is I'm very, very self-conscious that I'm a 21st century American writer trying to write a 19th century British character. I mean, you know, you can emulate the Conan Doyle style, but you really can't be Conan Doyle. It's too much of a reach. So when I look at a Doyle story, I look at his paragraphing and, you know, how much time he spends on a description of a character, and I say, well, he spends more time than I would normally do, and I try to stretch a little so I can be more Doyle-ish in my writing, but the fact is I tend to be more of a dialogue-driven writer, and he tends to be more of a narrative writer, so I have to compromise my own approach without sacrificing my gifts, because at this point in my career, I tend to dictate my first drafts on my iPad, and then I polish them and rewrite them and bring in the stuff that wouldn't come through if you're just sitting in a chair dictating a story.
So the question is, like, especially with Sherlock Holmes stories, it's a lot of Dr. Watson kind of narrating a bit. Do you try to capture Dr. Watson as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the only way to... I mean, I know other people do other approaches, but I'm trying to write a Sherlock Holmes story that you could slip into an existing anthology of Sherlock Holmes stories and say, yeah, that reads reasonably authentic. If you analyze it, you might say, well, there are things that are, you know, not purely Victorian in terms of... vocabulary and how, you know, how British English is written and how it sounds and how dialogue is. I do the best I can. I have an Irish mother. I had an Irish mother until she passed away. So some of that language and sensibility it was in the household when I grew up because she came from Ireland and she was of a much older generation than the current generation. She's been gone for a few years now. So I just do the best I can with the tools I have. But, I don't sit down and write a, let me do Sherlock Holmes my way, because I think there are people who do that and make interesting stories. But I find most interesting as a writer, because I've had this opportunity many, many times, is to slip into another writer's shoes, especially a deceased writer, and just say, okay, I'm going to be that writer. I'm going to use his vocabulary to the best of my ability. I'm going to see the world the way he sees it, and I'm going to depict his characters as authentically as I possibly can. That's my approach.
So you should have been an actor as well.
Yeah, maybe, except I can't act.
Well, half Hollywood can't act. But
Yeah, well, true.
I was going to, you know, do you worry about fans of, like, The Shadow or Sherlock Holmes and something like that not being happy with the way you write?
No, because, you know, not at this point, because from the beginning, my first Doc Savage, which I wrote is in 1979-80, and it wasn't published till about 1991, the reactions initially were, you know, some of them were, wow, this really was like Lester Dent wrote it. And I just had that gift, as I said. Sometimes someone will say, I published a Tarzan novel recently, and someone said, well, your Tarzan is a little rougher than Edgar Rice Burroughs' Tarzan in a couple spots. And I deliberately did that because he was in a situation that would make him, his polish would wear off a little. So you'd always get criticisms or someone who said, I don't know if that character would say those words, but for the most part, people accept my approach. I've been on the money for so long and in so many books that I don't worry about it, except in the sense of when I'm writing, rewriting, editing one of my books, I'm looking for the anachronism or the maybe the word choice isn't perfectly 1937 or 1894, and which is why when I'm doing these, and this is a problem for me, when I'm writing a book, let's say I'm writing Sherlock Holmes, I usually write short stories, so this isn't a big problem. But when I'm writing Sherlock Holmes, I'm also rereading Doyle. I'm not reading any other fiction. And the reason I'm not reading any other fiction is I tend to absorb the style of whoever I'm reading at a given time if I'm writing fiction at the same time. So I have to avoid reading for pleasure when I'm working on a book or a novel that's based on something that already exists. So I immerse myself, and that keeps me honest.
Hmm. Yeah, I ask a lot of writers that too, because some seem to be able to, be reading anything and doing whatever and write, and others don't. And I kind of agree with you there. I like to stay away from other works.
Yeah, I can't do it. Yeah. You know, I can't do it.
Yeah.
Successful. I remember once I was writing 4 Destroyers a year, and I was writing at that point 3 Doc Savages. And I wrote, I think, my 3rd Doc Savage, and I had like a 5 or 6 chapter start that the original writer had left behind. So I typed that up and I just ran with it. And I had a wonderful experience. I felt like this is really feeling authentic and this is a strong story. And when it was done, I wanted to do another, but I had a destroyer do. So I switched the destroyer. I switched too fast. And the writing picked up from Doc Savage in a way that I struggled with and I got control of, but some of it had an old, more old-fashioned, you know, writing style, and I was never happy with the book because, one, I didn't want to write it. I wanted to write a Doc Savage at that point because I was in that flow. But I was so in that flow, I couldn't get into the Destroyer flow, which was a 1990s book, so that was a contemporary series at that time. And, you know, so that's the trouble or the challenge of writing multiple books that are emulating different writers. So I try to stay with one writer for as long as I can, which doesn't happen that often, really. But I'd like to do it that way.
Hmm. So where did this come from? Like, when you started emulating other writers and doing these stories, like Sherlock Holmes, Shadow, Doc Savage, and all that, did you listen to the old radio shows and things like that, or were you influenced by it?
I wouldn't say influence in the way you're saying it, because I'm always influenced by the writer. I'm trying to capture the writer's style, words, approach, sensibility. But I grew up in the early 60s when The Shadow came back on radio in reruns. And so my exposure to The Shadow was initially in reruns of old-time radio and some comic book stuff that was coming out of that time that wasn't very authentic. I don't take from the radio so much because the Shadow novels are of a different type. The characters aren't quite the same, and the approach isn't quite the same, and one is a short radio story and the other is a novel. So, but I am strongly influenced by, you know, old-time radio in my enjoyment of things and in my sensibilities. I Love a Mystery is one of my favorite radio shows. And I remember listening, you know, to the Lone Ranger a lot, and I remember the Green Hornet. You know, I love the TV show and the radio show. And there were a few other things that I listened to sporadically, but the ones that most influenced me in the sense of they got me into old-time radio were The Shadow, The Green Hornet. I think The Third Man was another, too. That was a good show.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, to answer your question in a different way, I'll tell you a spooky story, which may, you know, may go to why I can do what I can do, but I don't know. Because at the time it happened, I thought about it one way, and I think about it differently now. When I first sat down to write my first novel, which was a Doc Savage novel, I had a 10-12-page outline that Lester Dent had written in 1934. They got it rejected for kind of a dumb reason. And I got permission from his widow to turn it into a novel and see if we could sell it to Bantam Books, who was doing Doc. So I you know, it was my first novel, so I approached it cautiously. So I wrote a little epilogue, I mean, a little prologue, and I typed out a first chapter on my old Olivetti portable typewriter that I had in those days. Then I wrote a second chapter the next day, and maybe the next day after that, and one day I'm sitting to write. And I had a strange experience. I had a sensation of someone standing behind me. No one was there. And all of a sudden, my energy just accelerated. And I think I wrote three chapters that day. And the next day, I wrote four or five or something crazy. And Lester Dent was a speed writer, but he used to dictate, too. And I had three or maybe 4 days in which I'm doing 20 pages one day, 30 pages the next day, 40 pages the next day. And then I crashed for several days. And then I went back to writing more in a chapter or two a day style. And I used to joke in those days, because I was in my 20s at that time. I would say, you know, it felt like almost like Lester Dent came up behind me and kind of just supercharged me or something. And that got me over the hump of writing a chapter a day, feeling my way forward. At that point, I had a lot of confidence. And I just followed the outline as best I could. And so, you know, I think to some degree when I do this stuff, for instance, I knew Walter Gibson created The Shadow. I knew how he thought. And I read most of his books, and he did hundreds. So between practically memorizing the books and just having that ability to kind of plug into someone's energy and channel them to a degree, channel them as filtered through my own sensibilities, I guess, you know, I just do it in a kind of organic, strange kind of way.
So I have
a question.
Does
that make any sense?
Yeah.
It does. I want to go back to Sherlock Holmes because I love whodunits and stuff. And mm-hmm. with let's say like those 10 stories you have there. Now, do you prepare by maybe listening to true crime or something like this, so to get some ideas?
No, not specifically. My inspirations for my Sherlock Holmes stories come from different places. There was one, the misadventure of the Bonnie Boy. I don't want to say what triggered it in precise terms, but I'd read a story a number of years ago about a boy who went missing, and many years passed, and they found him in an unusual place. And he wasn't murdered. He just got into a misadventure. And I when I started writing Sherlock Holmes stories, I thought of that story, and I said, well, you know, if you transport what happened to that kid to, you know, Victorian England, you can add a little bit of more mystery and a suggestion of the supernatural, you might have a story. So I did a story that was kind of downbeat. You know, Sherlock Holmes solves the mystery, but, you know, it's not a happy ending. There was one story. I happened to pick up a book that was in, you know, I buy books all the time, and I, unlike a lot of people, I don't read them right away, and I was clearing out, you know, some storage space, and I came across this book I'd never read on spontaneous human combustion, and I read it, and it's fascinating stuff, and, you know, but what's behind it? And it came to me that I could do a good Sherlock Holmes story around it, but how would Holmes explain the mystery? You know, because I'm sure you guys know what spontaneous human combustion stories are.
So
I came up with a story with an unusual ending because Sherlock Holmes had to resolve the mystery in on his own terms. You know, he's not a believer in the supernatural. We don't really want stories that are super science stories or science fiction. So I call that one the singular problem of the extinguished Wicks, and this involved two sisters whose last name was Wick, like Candlewick, and they were both found, you know, spontaneously combusted. Holmes, in my story, faced his most challenging challenge because the no easy solution presented itself. You couldn't come up with a solution that fit the facts. Like most spontaneous human combustion stories, you come up with a theory where you say, well, this could have happened and that could have happened, but they tend to break down when you analyze them because, you know, a lot of people have been found by their fireplace places or on their hearths, but burned up in a way that doesn't suggest a problem lighting the fireplace. So, you know, I don't really read true crime. I tend to write imaginative stories, although most of my stories with Sherlock Holmes are traditional and grounded. Once in a while we do deviate for a special anthology and we do something a little more recherché, as Holmes would say. But, you know, I look for something imaginative but plausible. And whether you're writing a Doc Savage or a Sherlock Holmes, you there's a technique of working from backwards from effect to cause. You know, for instance, if you find a body in an apartment where the body is completely consumed by fire, but the walls aren't burned and the furniture isn't burned, you've got a weird effect. And so the writer, as well as the protagonist, has to work backwards from something weird just happened here. We have to figure it out, and we have to have an understanding of it to solve the problem or to prevent it from happening again. So working from effect backwards to cause, because it's not a very interesting story if someone spontaneously combusts in front of witnesses and they say, oh, this is how it happened. And then, you know, what's the mystery? Where does the story go? You know, you want the solution at the end, not the beginning of the story.
So how did Dr. Watson handle this spontaneous combustion? How do you have the doc?
Well, I've written 22 Sherlock Holmes stories, most of the last 3 years. If you want me to remember any one of them, we're going to have a struggle here. I don't remember. You know, I mean, I just turned in one a couple of weeks ago, and I turned in another one last month, and, you know, in my mind, both of them are a little confused in terms of which is which. I know which is which, but, you know, if you want me to, I would say Watson is, you know, being a medical guy, probably looked at it from a medical standpoint and said, this is not possible, this is possible, this is how this might have happened. But, you know, you focus on Holmes more because he's the real analytical one. Watson is good for saying, you know, this is plausible, this is impossible, this is, you know, he's the one who's often befuddled, but helpful in terms of sorting things out. Where Holmes is looking at, okay, we can exclude this, we can't exclude that, we cannot assume murder, but we can't exclude it either. So, you know, his reaction to the discoveries is what is really of paramount importance, because he's the one who wrestles with them.
Hmm. You know, you talk about being authentic. Now, Sherlock Holmes has been, you know, updated so many times and written through the years and has resurgence. Do you think and do you like the later versions that you see of Sherlock Holmes on television and movies lately?
I don't watch hardly any of them. I saw the first Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes film, which I thought was good for what it was. That's now, what, 10 years ago? So, you know, once again, if you ask me to remember specifics, I don't really. I didn't see the second. I'm not seeing the Sherlock Holmes TV shows. And I haven't read anything that's Holmesian that isn't written by Doyle. So I don't have much of an opinion. I remember seeing some of the older Sherlock Holmes films on TV in the 60s or 70s and liking them for what they were. I'm not drawn to the modern versions. I'm more of a reader than a viewer. So if I want a Sherlock Holmes experience, I'm going to reach for one of the books and I'm going to reread a story or two.
You ever wonder why certain people like that, like why Sherlock Holmes is still so popular so many years later?
Well, I think I have an understanding because, you know, I write Sherlock Holmes partially because I was asked to write him and I found I had a knack for doing them. And because they're short, you can do a bunch of them fairly quickly and measured as in years, not in decades, as opposed to a novel. But, you know, if you think about the things that are popular, whether TV, movies, or whatever, the dating myself, something I like to use as an example is a TV show, The Honeymooners. Very limited vehicle, very limited cast, very formulaic in some ways, but also a lot of variation in the formula. If you watch any TV show that you liked or grew up on or you're watching now, and it has a comfortable set of characters, a certain predictability to those characters, and you like the stories, that is to say the genre or the kinds of stories that are built around the characters, you have familiarity, a level of predictability, which is a comfort zone, but also a level of unpredictability, which is the variations on the themes that people, you know, if you watch the old Seinfeld show, that show grew, but at a certain point it became static in terms of we knew who these characters were, and it was all about variations on various themes. The Honeymooners was that way. You know, every time Ralph Cramden said, "To the moon, Alice," he would give it a different inflection, intonation. It would be in a different context, even though it's usually in the same kitchen. And once in a while, he would just look at her and shake his fist, and you know he's thinking it. He doesn't have to say it. That's the variation that keeps you interested because it isn't constant repetition. So with the Holmes stories, to do an example, you know, once you've read a few, you know what the drill is. And if you like that drill, you're going back for the comfort, the familiarity, but also the variations and the themes, the exploitation of the situations. You know, occasionally there's a story Holmes narrates. Occasionally there's a story where, you know, Watson plays a greater role than normal. And sometimes they'll bring in Mycroft Holmes, not often, but enough to say, well, this is different. But it's still a Sherlock Holmes story. So people like the repetition, the familiarity, and the variations that allow for novelty. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, totally. Totally. Have you ever thought about making major changes to a story?
What do you mean?
Or a character, like making, them a different character, like
no,
Sherlock Holmes.
No, because I write the stories I would want to read if only someone had written them. For instance, my newest novel is Tarzan, Conqueror of Mars. We put Tarzan on Mars so we could meet John Godreau Mars, who is Edgar Rice Burroughs' other major character, and people have been talking about writing such a book for a long time, and a few people have taken a swing at it, not necessarily successfully and not necessarily in an authorized manner. And I got the right to put them together in a way that worked for the licensor, worked for me, and according to the reviews, works for the reader. I would never think of why don't I just take these characters and just change them up because, you know, I know an audience exists for a Tarzan.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Story. I know an audience exists for a John Carter story, and I know an audience definitely exists for a story where they both meet. I don't think those characters could be improved upon, not in that context. I would never think of updating Sherlock Holmes because I wouldn't know what to do with him. I thought about updating Doc Savage, who's a 1930s character, but if you take a character like that who's very much a man of his time, even though he's ahead of his time, I'm not sure who he'd be. I'm not sure how he'd talk. I'm not sure what his morality would be. I'm not sure what his drive would be. But in his time, because he was a man of his time, he makes sense. He doesn't make sense necessarily in the 21st century because the stories of the 1930s that were ahead of their time, like by 20, 25 years, maybe more, well, what's ahead of our time? That's a bigger speculation, you know. Our world is a science fiction world. We carry our telephones in our pockets. We're driving increasingly sophisticated automobiles and flying increasingly sophisticated planes. It's harder to predict what the future is going to be without being out-and-out science fiction. And not everybody likes out-and-out science fiction. They might like science adventure, which is just the flavor of futuristic science built on an adventure story. So I don't really think of, I've created my own characters. I created the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl from Marvel Comics. That's a successful character now. But I don't really think in terms of updating or improving characters. I like them the way they are, so that's how I write them. That's how people want them, in my opinion.
That's pretty interesting. So Tarzan is on Mars.
Poor Tarzan, you know, there's no jungles on Mars. Well, there's some jungle, but there's hardly any jungles on Mars. It's mostly sand and Dead Sea bottoms, and he arrives the way John Carter arrives, completely buck naked, no weapons, no nothing. And it's like, what do I do now? His objective is simply, I want to go home. I want to go back to Africa. And so that's that story. As simple as that sounds, it turns into a big epic story. But, you know, his mission is a very simple one. I want to go home. How do I get there? Who can help me? Who are my enemies? Where do I find food? Is there water on this planet? The story starts very simply with a story of survival. He doesn't know where he is. He doesn't know where the food is. You know, are there any apes on this planet? You know, are there any trees? Is there fruit? You know, he doesn't see anything when he first arrives. And that's a big deal for a character who's very much in command of his environment on Earth. He's the lord of the jungle. You take him out of the jungle, it's like, what's he the lord of?
No cheetah.
I have a question.
Sure.
What do you prefer more? Do you prefer the full novel or the anthologies?
To Sherlock Holmes, or in what? Okay, you know, Sherlock Holmes.
Compared to, wouldn't that be the Tarzan would be a full novel, wouldn't it?
Tarzan is a full novel. I'm a novelist and a short story writer, so I like both. In terms of Sherlock Holmes, it's funny. I prefer the short stories because you can read them quickly and in one sitting. I read all of the Holmes novels except Hounds of the Baskervilles, which I've been waiting for a special occasion. And part of the reason I put it off is I know the story. I've seen film adaptations and comic adaptations, so there's no big discovery there. But I will enjoy reading it because it's his best novel in most people's opinion. So in terms of Sherlock Holmes, I like him best as a short story character, but I've been toying with an idea of maybe not doing a novel, but a novelette, where Sherlock Holmes interacts with the Martians from the War of the Worlds. An idea that's been done several times, but apparently not very well, according to reviews, because people have tended to, the previous writers have tended to put the character smack in the middle of the H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, where he really doesn't have much to do, because we already know how that story ends. You know, Earth people are basically helpless against the Martians until nature takes its course. And I've been thinking, well, you know, if there's a second invasion, maybe Holmes might have something to do and might be able to affect the outcome of that invasion. So I might take a swing at maybe not a novel, but a novelette or a novella. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
Do you worry about modern politically correct viewpoints on some of these older stories and kind of a lot of things that are important to people in the 1800s and the way they interact with each other, much different than what you see nowadays and what people complain about nowadays? So
I wouldn't say worry about it, but I'm sensitive to it. I'll give you an example. Back in the 90s, I wrote a Doc Savage novel that was set in the early 30s, and it had a was based on another Dent outline, and it had a lot of Asian characters, Fu Manchu kind of characters. And so when I wrote that story, I wrote it in the sensibility of 1934 or 5 or whatever it was, with a lot of leering yellow faces and, you know, slant-eyed this and this, because that was how the pulp writers wrote. About 7 or 8 years ago, I wrote a 1940-something Doc Savage that took place in Mongolia. Now, by 1940-something, the pulp writers weren't writing that old Fu Manchu style of stuff. They were more sophisticated, and so was this writer, Lester Dent. So when I wrote that one, all that stuff went out the door. I wasn't going to do it that way. I was going to do it a little more sensitively, or a little more, less cliched. And, you know, we would say racist now. I'm not sure that it's always racist when someone is, a white person is struggling to describe another culture or another or people from another culture. It may be just how it's just point of view. You know, I along that line, there was, I always remember a funny anecdote, funny to me, that I saw on the news somewhere. A black defendant was getting having a hard time with his young white female public defender, and he was looking at jail time, and she was trying to defend him, and he wasn't thinking she was in job, and he lost his temper, and he called her a pointy-nosed bitch. And I thought, well, that's a very interesting point of view from a black person's point of view, that the white girl would be pointy-nosed. Now, you could say that's racist, which it is from the standpoint of, well, you know, if the white person was a minority, you might say, well, pointy-nosed. That's derogatory. But I thought, as a writer and observer, I said, well, you know, that's a refreshing point of view from my point of view. It's like, yeah, pointy-nosed. I got to remember that. You know, I wouldn't necessarily use it in the story, but it's like, well, that's an interesting viewpoint. Just as, you know, when the first white people and the first Asians, you know, encountered one another, you know, the white person was seen as round-eyed and the Asian person was seen as oblique-eyed or slant-eyed or whatever. Almond Eyes was a pulp style description. Those things that you could say, yeah, that's racist from the point of view of different lenses at which you look at different people who you see as different from yourself. But I don't know that they're racist in the sense of necessarily being hateful or negative. It's just like, well, this is, you know, how this person looks to me, and this is how this person looks to me. So I, you know, I'm aware of it. I agent the Lester Dent stories, and I recently proofread two of his Black Mass stories, which are going to be reprinted. And there was a Dent used in his story, you know, he was in a restaurant, and he mentioned the waiter, and he was referred to as a darky waiter. And I'm thinking, darky. Do we want that? Do we not want that? I don't like changing things in previous published stories, but it's like, well, we have to be, you know, more and more sensitive and more aware of, okay, is that going to ruin the story for somebody? Is someone going to say, whoa, you know, or is someone going to say, Lester Dent, he was a racist. He used the word darky in 1936. Then there was another reference. I won't say the word, but there was a, there's a, a word for a bollard, which is a thing on a wharf or a dock where you tie the rope around, and they're black, and they were called N-word heads, one word, N-word heads. And I'm thinking, okay, first of all, I didn't know what the word meant. I had to look it up, and I looked at that, and I said, I don't think we want that word in here, even though it refers to an inanimate object. So I looked it up. I said, oh, it's a bollard. Okay, we're going to change that to bollard. That's a no-brainer, because nobody now is going to know what the word meant, and even now, not everybody knows what a bollard is, so we changed that. And we'll probably change the darkie, but I had to think about that. It's like, okay, well, you know, that's not good, but it's not bad. It's like when I grew up, you know, there was an older generation that referred to black people as colored people. And, you know, even though you were a kid, you kind of cringed when you heard that, because it was like, if it wasn't negative, it was at least old-fashioned. Whereas when I was really young, Negro was the usual term, and that evolved into black. At one point, black, if you went back decades, black was a negative word, you know, because black people aren't really black. They're brown for the most part.
What's
so we're going off on a tangent, but, you know, did I answer your question?
A little bit, but I want to expound upon a little bit. Sherlock Holmes was 1894, and what I do is I do research with Jack the Ripper, 1888, and one of the fiction novels that I wrote, I wanted to have contemporary jokes from the Scotland Yard personnel, because one of the Scotland Yard personnel, which I think Conan Doyle even used, his name was Frost, but he was a jokester. So I looked up 19th century jokes, and I think 99% of them were about slamming on the Irish. It was all of this. So it took me a while to find a joke that wasn't so bad.
so that's the problem.
I understand.
You know, people, you know, as time passes and people pass away, we lose sense of how aware previous generations were to things that we don't pay much attention to. People used to be really focused on other people's religion, you know. That used to be a thing. Like the house I grew up in, one of the houses I grew up in, for a long time, the deed said you can't be sold to a Catholic. Well, that's illegal now. But at one point, house deeds, you know, would have these religious restrictions that are crazy to us. Who cares who buys your house if you're getting your price? I remember John Nanovic, the editor of The Shadow, Doc Savage, of these pulps, he told me this story. And I think it's an interesting story because it sounds crazy now, but it was the way things were. He wanted to move into a neighborhood, but Catholics weren't allowed to move into the neighborhood, except there was an exception. If you worked in the arts, well, he edited pulp magazines, which weren't seen as the arts, but it was enough an exception that he could move into this neighborhood in Jackson Heights, New York, just outside of New York City. And it was a restricted neighborhood, but it was restricted against Catholics. I would assume it would also be restricted against other people, but it was specifically against Catholics as far as white people and their religions. And it's like, you know, people thought those things were important in those days, that they would draw those lines. And, you know, in our modern world, when I meet someone, I don't know what their religion, I don't ask, I don't even think about it. Doesn't occur to me to even think about, you know, yeah, if someone is Muslim, you know, that might or might not be evident fairly quickly. If someone's Jewish, it's neither here nor there, but it also might be relatively evident, you know, if you got to know a person. But if someone is Presbyterian or Methodist or, you know, any of the Christian denominations, it's like, I don't care about that. I wouldn't even know what a Methodist is, necessarily. I couldn't write you three paragraphs on what a Methodist is versus a Presbyterian or versus anything. But previous generations used to be very fixated on these caste, class. Like in the South, it used to be, and probably still is, who you're related to had more to do with your status than what you did. Where in the North and probably the West, what you do confers more information or acceptance than who your relatives were, because you know, in the 20th century especially, there's a lot more upward mobility. And we're certainly not talking about Sherlock Holmes and the Pulps, are we?
Right, right. So now when you're reading, you said that you read Conan Doyle a little bit to get the flavor again. You can probably pick up things of the historical nature too, probably, I guess. Would that be correct?
You mean in reading the stories?
You know, like reading Conan Doyle's stories, you may pick up some of, his bias, but let's say how they were speaking back then. And
you'd pick up as much as you could. But, you know, British English can be very different than U.S. English. And there's subtleties and there's, you know, turns of phrases or twists of words that would go over our heads in the 21st century that, you know, a contemporary writer would say, oh, that's like the Southern phrase, oh, bless his heart. If you're not Southern or not familiar with, you think that's sort of a compliment. When it's not necessarily a compliment, it can be very derogatory. So you miss that stuff.
Right, right.
And I'm not sure I'm that close a reader to always pick up on these things, which is why I think I feel very self-conscious about writing Sherlock Holmes, and I work hard to overcome that.
I think as I read, you know, with the Jack Rippers, kind of the same time, is the phrase out to sea, that they were using that phrase, even in England, and I had never heard of that, but then, of course, you learn more and more about it once you keep on doing it.
It very interesting to go online and look up things about Victorian London that would give me insights. For instance, I don't know how I came across it, but I came across something about the watermen at the time, the guys who used to have these little boats and they ferried people across the Thames and across various waterways. And in Holmes' time, or Doyle's time, this was a dying occupation, but it was still there. And you had all these water stairs on the Thames where you could go walk down the stairs and there'd be a little boat and a guy would scull you across to the opposite shore. And I built a story around that little subculture that was dying. It used to be one of the big occupations of London leading up to the Victorian people. It was a story called The Adventure of Old Black Duffel. And it was about a waterman who wore a black duffel coat, and there was mysterious things going on around him. And that, like, that sense of that culture and the dying culture was something, and I don't know why Doyle didn't write about it, because it's perfect. And just as you research, Jack the Ripper and what surrounds, you know, that event in Whitechapel and the nearby areas and what the culture was like and what prostitution was like then, and you know, you get all these insights that you could never get from your imagination.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
And that's what you have to ground yourself in the reality of that world to write a sensible story. You can, as an American, make up a wonderful Sherlock Holmes story, but a British person would say, well, it could never happen that way because we didn't have this at that time. That came later, and this and that, and this and that. And you write a story that, you know, the uneducated Sherlock Holmes fan would say, that's not a bad story. But the educated Sherlock Holmes would say, no, you got the time period wrong. You have things happening before they could possibly happen. Technology that's 20 years later, you know, you have to be careful about that stuff.
Right. Now, I could talk for hours with you, in this case, is there any place where, do you have a website that people could go to or a place where people could find out more about you and your work?
Well, my website for selling books is www.adventuresinbronze.com. Adventures in Bronze is all one word, lowercase. That's where all my currently in print books are, but they're also on Amazon.com, Kindle, Nook, etc. But adventuresinbronze.com is where you can see my my last 10 years worth of output, approximately.
Okay. Great.
Wow. So now, what do you got planned next? Where do you want to go from here?
Well, I'm talking about maybe doing a few more Doc Savages. I've got a Sherlock Holmes War of the Worlds idea. A sequel to Tarzan Conqueror Mars is in the discussion stage. We haven't committed to it. I'm wrapping up my second spider novel. The spider is like the shadow, but he's kind of like the bipolar version of the shadow. He's definitely got some mental health issues, and that makes him very interesting. And that's what I've learned. And more home stories. You know, I just turned in one, and I've got a plan for at least one more. And beyond that, well, that's a lot already. It depends on what contracts come through, what agreements are made, what I do next. I'll probably write some Lovecraftian short stories because I do those from time to time, and there's some anthologies opening up looking for stories in that area.
So nothing's really planned. It just sort of happens in a way.
If I sign a contract for 3 books, that's 3 books, but that doesn't mean I don't add a fourth from another contract in the middle of them. It all depends on how certain negotiations shake out and when they shake out. Because sometimes I could start the week saying, I don't have a next book. And by Friday, I have 4 next books. Okay, which one do I do first? I'm always in discussion about what licenses, because most of my stuff is licensed properties. It's like, okay, what can I do next? What do people want me to do? What do the readers want? What are the licensors willing to do? And it's kind of like sometimes you're waiting for things to gel, and sometimes the sky opens up and you have to do a whole bunch of stuff all at once, almost.
but maybe the mood, sort of how, what kind of mood you're in? Or?
I wish my mood governed what I wrote. I really wish I could just sit down and write what I felt like one day, which rarely happens. It's like, what's due? What anthologies are open up? What's the next deadline for the next anthology that I promised a story? For instance, I was recently approached to write a story for an interesting anthology set in the various occupied zones post-World War II. Occupied Germany, occupied Japan, occupied Italy. And I said, well, that's a very interesting anthology. Going to have to really struggle to find a plot, but I did, a plot and a hero. And that's due in December, and if nothing is happening, I'll probably write it before December, but if other things are happening, I won't write it until December. Mood. I wish I could write based on what I wanted to write, but it's all about juggling the opportunities and getting stories done in an orderly fashion so that the editors have them on time or before time. And, you've got to be careful about starting a novel before you have a contract. Sometimes things go awry. So, yeah, I would love to sit down and write a Doc Savage and wait the contract and show up later. Well, no, we can't take a chance on that. We just don't want to be putting time into something that might fizzle. Not that I expect anything to fizzle, but sometimes contracts take a lot longer than you think, and you really have to be intelligent about what you're doing next. I would love to be a mood writer and say, I feel like writing this today. Yeah, I do. when the Sherlock Holmes mood comes on me and there's nothing else going on, I will write a Sherlock Holmes story. But usually what happens if someone says, I need a story in a month, it's like, yeah, I can do that. And that's my mood. Yeah, I'll get it done in a month.
Yeah, but so right now someone approaches you and you get a contract and you're going to be writing a story, whether it's Doc Savage or Holmes or whatever. So you've got this story you're writing and something happens in the world, like what's been going on with COVID and the protests and all the different turmoil going on. Does that influence your mood in writing? Does that influence the way you write?
No, because, I work out of my home.
Right.
Technically, it's a 7-day-a-week work, schedule.
Yeah.
In the sense of always being aware that any day I wake up, I might be doing something either because I want to or I have to or there's nothing else better to do. And because I don't write contemporary fiction except very rarely now, the outside world doesn't matter very much. I'm not a theme writer. I'm more of an action-adventure writer and a mystery writer and sometimes a science fiction writer in a limited sense of science fiction, not in a Star Trek sense of science fiction. So, I'm in a different bubble than other writers who respond to the real world that they live in and write to that. I write for an audience who's interested in stories that were published 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years ago, 100 years ago. That's my audience. That's my mentality. That's what I do.
Hmm. Well, yeah. I just wondered if it made you, it made a darker mood in maybe the story, a darker feel to it if something dark is happening in your own life.
Well, again, I write escapist fiction. I don't write personal fiction.
Right.
So I don't, you know, I can't say that because I'm not trying to reflect anything. And I don't put myself in the stories. I really try to be the other writer, usually the dead writer. except when I was writing The Destroyer, the two writers were still alive and I was a ghost. But, I mean, you know, that's a question for someone writing contemporary fiction and who are part of their generation. I live in the past. I write in the past. I'm just in a completely different reality than the things you're describing. I don't relate to them.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not trying to teach the world anything. You know, yeah. I write such different. I mean, I have done things that are a little out there. I channeled a book once, but it's a book about God, and you know, even that doesn't have anything to do with me. It's a channeled book. We're literally channeled book. So it's like, well, that's over in that pocket, and my other pulp stuff is in this pocket. And Sherlock Holmes is not really pulp, but it's kind of in the mystery pocket. But, you know, I don't relate to these questions because they don't have anything to do with what I do. I know it sounds crazy, but I'm not a writer of my time.
No,
you know, in that sense. Not now, anyway. When I did The Destroyer for 10 years, yeah, it was all contemporary stuff. Yeah, that was different. I mean, I could answer that question based on that. I haven't written a Destroyer since 96, so, yeah. But back then, I was constantly reading the headlines. I was constantly thinking ahead of the headlines. I used to write stories that would be speculative, and when they came out, they'd be right on the money in spooky ways. Or it was more contemporary 9 or 12 months after I wrote it, when it comes out, than when I wrote it. And, you know, that was happening constantly in crazy ways. And the Will Murray of that time could say, yeah, I'm constantly reading newspapers, watching the news, trying to stay on top of things so I can write about world events in my Destroyer novels, which were political, satirical, science fiction, fantasy, adventure, escapist novels. There, I was really connected to it, but I don't do those books anymore.
Mm. Wow. You're a fascinating writer. We appreciate you for being on the show and talking about your books. We'll have we'll have you up on our website as well, so people listening can just do one click and they'll find your work. Murray,
that's great.
Thank you for
being here. I'm glad to be here. This is fun. I haven't done radio in a long time.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.